As a proud sponsor of both the 2016 Sundance Film Festival and the No Film School podcast, Canon USA would like to celebrate the filmmakers behind the camera. Canon Cinema EOS. Go wherever the story takes you. Sundance is one of the best film festivals in the world for both feature films and short films, but it's not the only place for great short films. My Road Reel is perhaps the largest short film competition in the world. Presented by Australian film company Rode Microphones, the competition is kicking off very shortly for its third consecutive year. Register your interest at myroadreel.com. Hey everyone out there in the podcast universe, I'm Micah Van Hove with No Film School. This year I had the opportunity to host a panel at the Canon Creative Studio called Collaborations, Cinematography and Editing, and we're about to roll that for you right now. Thanks everybody for coming and checking out this panel. We're pretty excited to be here at the Canon Creative Studio at Sundance 2016, presenting this conversation with two very talented filmmakers. And this is going to be actually available on nofilmschool.com as a podcast that we're putting out. I'm Micah, I'm a contributor at No Film School, and we're really happy to be talking about the film Author, the J.T. Leroy story today. So yeah, Author is the story of a novelist and punk author, Laura Albert, who in the 90s began publishing books under a fake literary persona known as J.T. Leroy. And we're really happy to have cinematographer Richard Henkels and editor Michelle M. Witten here to talk about the relay race relationship between cinematographer and editor. So welcome, guys.
Oh, thank you very
much.
Thank
you.
So yeah, for those who will be listening to this at home, can you guys just introduce yourselves briefly so we can get familiarized with your voice?
I'm Michelle Witten. I was the editor of the film.
Richard Henkels, the cinematographer.
Let's get started by talking about how you guys got involved with this project and what attracted you to it.
Well, I first worked with Jeff on a short called The Dude about 5 years ago. And at the time, he was telling me about this story that he was developing about author J.T. Leroy, and he started sending me a bunch of articles so I could get familiar with it, because he said, you know, this is going to be my next film, and I want you to cut it. And, you know, cut to December 2014, I started cutting with him again, and cut to exactly 1 week ago, we QC'd the DCP and then premiered it a couple days later.
And I met Jeff on a commercial shoot that kind of went a little haywire and turned into a bit of a classical train wreck. And we bonded in the war zone, to say the least. And he was looking for a cinematographer. He was already in production on the film. And we hit it off, and I said, tell me when you're ready to dive back in and shoot. Give me a call. And 3 months later, you know, I dug in and got to work.
I just first want to sort of talk about you know, the collaboration between editor and cinematographer in the documentary process. I mean, when you're shooting documentary and you have what's, you know, often mountains of footage, and you don't always know, you know, what's going to make it in and what's not going to make it in, what kind of conversations do you have, if any, with the editor beforehand?
In this particular film, it really wasn't about having mountains of footage. I mean, we had Laura Albert's entire archive, which was a lot of Tupperware bins of photos and documents and everything. So it really wasn't about going out and shooting a bunch of footage, like verite footage. It was, I think Richard would probably agree that the process was like extremely controlled in terms of what we were shooting.
Yeah, Jeff's an incredible designer. He's a very meticulous director. So when I came onto it, he actually shot pre-visualized scenes. So him and Michelle could actually figure out the exact timing. So when we sat down and actually shot, Michelle would spit out those pre-vis moments. So when we were actually be on set, we could actually look at how exactly our pieces were going to slip in.
Oh, wow.
And then Lucas Seller, who's Jeff's assistant, who was assisting Michelle, would then take live right then on our set and down-res it and shoot it off to Michelle, and she could pop it in right away. So it was like a very, like real-time experience of like working with an editor, you know, a director, and actually an in-house effects person. It was really exciting.
Wow, so a lot of like, that seems rare for a documentary to have pre-visualization like that.
It was, yeah, incredibly rare. I mean, this documentary is not a typical documentary. I mean, it's like, it's a very meticulously, beautifully designed piece that Jeff and Michelle put together.
It's got a very handmade type quality to it.
Incredibly handmade. So we manipulated the images a lot in the sense where Jeff was very adamant about wanting a super clean image. We shot everything at 320 ASA. We found that to be our happy medium. Everything was shot on Canon. Able Cinetech was very, very good to us. They supported us through the whole journey. Shot 80% of it on a C500 with the Ajabox 4K, and everything was shot with a pretty deep stop at about 5.6. So we could have really deep focus. So when we were in post, when Michelle wanted to do moves, either XY zooms or push-ins or recropping, we would have no loss of resolution.
For the shoot, we had these more sort of high-tech shoots where, you know, Richard had a crew and motion control, and then we had these more sort of low-tech shoots where it would be really just like basically in our office, like 5 feet away from the editing suite, you know, shooting a lot of tabletop stuff. And what was cool about that is that, you know, Richard and Lucas and Jeff could, you know, could shoot all this stuff and then pass it over to me, you know, 5 feet away, and I could cut it together, and, you know, we could see, and, you know, really quick, you know, do we need to reshoot anything? Like, how does this look? Do we want to get closer, you know, further away? You know, it was a really great process that you don't usually have that experience. You know, usually there's a little bit of a lag before you can cut the footage in. And
yeah, as anybody knows, I mean, when you're doing a documentary, it's not like a normal shoot. Everything's kind of really scaled down. So with this film, we had a handful of days where we actually really crewed up, where we had a proper film setting, where we would set up environments that they lived in. And then we would do these studies on those environments while the VO was being played, you know, over the images.
Jeff always called them ghost recreations.
Recreations,
ghost
right?
Recreations. Yeah. No people, just the environment, and, you know, and a lot of moves, and a lot of we did a lot of jump cutting within the environment. So, you know, you'd be pushing in, and then suddenly like cut, and something would appear, but the movement would feel really fluid and
And uninterrupted. That came in kind of like a happy mistake where Jeff was like, all right, like this is what I want, this is what I'm looking for. How are we going to do it? Is it a dolly or is this and that? And like, so I said, well, actually, I have the perfect person, my key grip. Jerry Jacalone has this company called The Slider, which is a sliding ubangi that he has set up actually for motion control. It's belt-driven. It's a very simple setup. That's very, very simple computer setup. It's not like an overly complicated MoCos thing. And we just basically would do these pre-programmed MoCo moves, even though we weren't necessarily always using the repeated movement. It just allowed us to do these insanely smooth, meticulous moves that no human could ever do.
Right, in keeping with the very clean, very meticulous, and very smooth aesthetic you guys are going for.
Exactly. So, but back to what Michelle was getting at. So we crewed up, or actually we ended up, we took over Jeff's house for 4 days, invaded his house. He sent his wife and his son off up north camping while we pretty much used his house as our film set. That's where we would actually do like these more complicated shots. And then when we would scale down, we would then do these really small, compact setups where it was just me and Lucas and Jeff, and we would actually be shooting literally right next to Michelle. When she's cutting, we would literally like set up and invade her space with like all of her C-stands and her lights. And that those shoots were with the 1DC, which we ended up loving. Like the hyped up, DSLR on steroids, because it shoots internal 4K, and it really freed us up, because then I didn't have to really deal with like a first AC and going to Able Cinetech to prep a whole camera package. We could just basically be like, okay, you know, let's put together a shoot like in 2 days. I used a couple vintage old Nikkor lenses with the Novaflex lens adapter. And we just would do these really casual sort of powwow group meetings while Michelle was over at the other end of the room editing.
With her headphones on, yeah.
Yeah, she got quite tired of us after a while invading her space.
Well, you know, there's one of the motifs in the film is these micro cassettes, and, you know, they were shooting with these macro lenses. And, you know, Richard did this beautiful lighting job, but we had, you know, so many different cassettes that we were shooting that, you know, it couldn't all be done in one day. So it was like hot set, you know, so we would be like climbing over, you know, all the lights and everything. Every time we would like leave the, you know, I think we were in like a 700 square foot office space doing this.
I've been known, I'm the master of the one light, but 30 C stand guy.
Seems like a really unique and an ambitious way to craft this film, because it's not, I mean, usually you kind of associate documentary with, you know, you go out and shoot a bunch of stuff and then you go into post and you figure it out or slowly, but it seems like you guys were very close together during the whole process. And I described this as a relay race earlier. What was it like for you, Michelle, as an editor, like being, you know, were they just running footage to you all the time and like always looking over your shoulder and stuff like that?
Well, you know, I mean, it at certain points, because, you know, what Richard was talking about before, you know, Jeff and I would, you know, we would, as we're cutting each scene, you know, we would know, okay, well, this is, you know, we want to have a shot of, you know, like booming down on, you know, an author's desk, you know, with their book on the desk or something. So we would, you know, go into Google and pull all these, you know, pull images and slap something together to, you know, kind of mock up what we wanted to do and time it out and everything. And so then we had these very concentrated periods of time where we were doing production and really taking that and making beautiful, you know, Richard and Jeff were making, you know, beautiful footage. So it really wasn't, it was only these, you know, it was only some very specific times during the post process. I think you guys really started shooting more like August, right? So it was really like the last 4 months of the process that, that we were getting this kind of footage in. I mean, the rest of it was really archival. You know, we were very fortunate to have a certain amount of archival video footage and then a ton of photographs that we really had to, you know, figure out how to incorporate in. But fortunately, Laura Albert documented so much of her life, so that's a real gift.
Yeah. I also always think about like something that Gordon Willis would always say, that like you can't shoot unless you know how to edit. And I wondered if you, what your thoughts are on that, if you agree with that, and if that applied to this process. It seems like it was a bit of a unique situation for this project, but you know, having access to what the director wanted to do in the edit, you know, while you're shooting is, like we said, unique. But you know, how do you think about, how much do you think about the editing when you're shooting?
Always. I mean, yeah, I'm constantly editing. Yeah, you know, it's very important. You know, it's important to be a musician, have a bit of, you know, rhythm, and as well being an editor. It's very important knowing timing and you know, and beats and moments. Especially when you're doing like operating, you're working with actors. Knowing like when to act and when not to like act, when to move the camera, when not to move the camera.
There's something that's interesting about editing for me is it's a part of the process that usually is intended to remain invisible. You don't want the editing to take you out of a story. You want it to just stitch through the whole film and be consistent and smooth. But there are also times when you use an edit to a certain effect, a certain punctuation, to heighten a certain element. When do you, you know, how do you arrive at those decisions when to use an edit visibly or invisibly?
Jeff has a very particular style that he likes. He likes very percussive editing and hard cut sound design, because he's always saying, you know, you want to keep the audience alive. You know, you never want them to go to sleep in their seat. So he actually really likes this, you know, the idea of like kind of keeping the audience on their toes and switching gears and really shocking them just a little bit. So, you know, we used a lot of sound effects for, you know, punctuation, a lot of sound effects like on cuts. And, you know, so that was a very specific style that, you know, for me, it's maybe not necessarily my personal style, but it serves the film really well. And I think it works incredibly well in the story that we were telling. And so I had to kind of get into that mode and really, you know, tell the story in that way.
But that's an excellent point. I mean, especially now, you don't want people going to sleep on your movie, you know, because there's so many movies out there. There's so many reasons, you know, to not pay attention in a certain way in our mm-hmm. in our world right now, which is insane.
All filmmakers, it doesn't matter if they're working on a major motion picture or a small indie, have one thing in common: a desire and a need to bring the images on the big screen to life. For decades, Canon has been committed to developing and engineering the most pristine optics to solve filmmakers' creative and technical challenges. Because Canon understands that it all begins with the lens. Learn more at glassfirst.com. With more than 2,000 short films from 89 different countries and close to 500,000 in prizes given away to date, My Road Reel is the world's largest short film competition. Proudly presented by Australian film company Rode Microphones, the competition is kicking off for its third year shortly, which promises to be its biggest yet, with huge prize packages and an international judging panel of recognized film experts. To find out more, watch films from the previous years, and to register your interest in this year's competition, visit myroadreel.com.
Speaking of shooting and in a documentary environment with documentary subjects, talking heads, as your role as a cinematographer, what things do you do to promote good discussion while you're shooting? I mean, obviously it's the director's job to facilitate the discussion, but, you know, as a cinematographer, what are you doing to keep that feeling while you're shooting? Are you taking a back seat? Are you trying to remain invisible, or are you being very friendly and upfront?
Jeff and I knew that we wanted this to be a film. We didn't want it to feel like a TV documentary. So whenever we would block shots or talk about shots, composing, moves, lighting, we would always talk about, you know, setting a tone, setting a mood, and making sure that it felt like a film, like we're telling a story. We wanted to really elevate the level of the quality.
To cinema.
Yeah, to cinema, yeah. We were shooting for the big screen. We're not shooting for this to be seen on TV, even though it'll probably mostly be seen on TV, but
right.
Yeah.
Well, but how does that affect your approach to actually shooting interviews?
Not in any way. It's just more about, like, you know, style of lighting, camera move.
Let's talk about those elements a little bit. I mean, you just said the one light 40 C-stand approach. What kind of approach do you take to shooting interviews, especially for this project, and what's your philosophy on lighting in general?
The philosophy in lighting is I like indirect light. You need to make a person feel comfortable, so you need to create a space to allow them to relax. So that's all the way from having the camera not be in their face to not having light that's completely blaring in their eye. I love indirect light. I love soft bounce sources, keeping it very simple, very naturalist, cutting the light. Instead of adding light, you know, add a flag or, you know, work with what's already there.
Absolutely, yeah. And you're using longer lenses mm-hmm. to keep distance from the subject.
Exactly,
as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, what lights did you use for this film? Did you use one light for most of it?
We had a pretty small little package. We didn't really, everything was lit incandescent. I'm not a big fan of kinephos. Just a small airy kit. And I'm a big fan of the Dato sources, and Jeff ended up loving them. A little small focusable 150-watt Dato lights with lenses and irises to be able to, like, really go in there and finesse, you know, to really draw your eye where you want people to look.
And we spoke about it a little bit earlier, but what's the first thing you look for, or the thing, the qualities in a camera that you look for when choosing one for a project?
The thing that I like about Canon, and it's very similar to Aeroflex, is that the Canon sensor that Jeff and I really loved is how it sees color. It's very natural. It's not hyper-forced. The contrast is very soft. The whites are very soft. It just has a very filmic quality to it. So that's really kind of what I look for. I mean, I pretty much use... when I choose the camera, is really directed towards the project. So I'm not opposed to shooting on any particular type of camera I shoot. If the subject requires for it to be hyper sharp with you know, an insane resolution, then you go big. You know, if not, then you know you can go. If you have to be really small, compact, then you set that camera to be like, you know, to be as light as possible.
Great. And let's talk a little bit about editing workflow for this. It sounds like it was a pretty unique workflow. What's the first thing you do when you start getting footage, and how do you integrate footage in your workflow?
If I'm lucky enough to have an assistant, then, which sometimes I am not, you know, then I get to walk into a situation where everything has already been sunk up and, you know, organized according to my liking, and, you know, I'd start watching footage. I mean, in this film, you know, Jeff and I sat and watched Laura's interview. It took us a number of days. We just sat, and she had 7 days of interview footage, and we sat and watched it and just took notes on it and put markers in. I'm a big believer in markers. Watch interviews, drop markers, make subclips, and string them out. That's how I usually start. This was the first feature that I had done on Premiere. So I had done, I'd been working in Final Cut 7 for a number of years, and, you know, and then Final Cut 10 came out. I know a lot of us were a little disappointed, but then last year I did 2 shorts on Premiere just to kind of, because I knew I was coming onto this project, and you know, Jeff and I had discussed, you know, were we going to go Avid, were we going to go Premiere, you know, were we going to go Final Cut X, and I said we're not going Final Cut X, and so I did 2 shorts on Premiere just to kind of get, you know, an understanding of the workflow and you know, really set up, you know, the hotkeys to my liking. I mean, that was a really nice thing, is I could kind of make it feel a lot like Final Cut 7. And so, you know, and even you could even change, like, how it looked, like the color of it, you know, you could shift that. And I got used to it. You know, there are a couple of snags, but...
Yeah, but going back to the interviews, so it was a single camera interview set up, and Jeff and Michelle created this really great style where, since we shot 4K, they were able to, like, literally zoom in and move around and make one camera, keeping the eye line directly down mm-hmm. the barrel of the lens, mm-hmm. you know, and create this jumpy style to keep the moments.
The percussiveness of it, you know. Yeah, exactly. You know, sometimes we would have these, you know, there were definitely times where we would hold on Laura. There's a couple instances in particular where, you know, I would be putting together a scene and I would just be like, God, I don't want to cut away from her. She's so good right now. And it's just, you know, and even moments where she was just looking into the camera. And so there's some very specific moments every time I watch the film. I love them. They're some of my favorite moments where we don't cut away. We just hold. And, you know, with the 4K and the ability to cut up the interview. So without having 2 cameras, you know, we could really cut up the interview and use the best parts of it. But sometimes it was like you just want to hold and just watch her. She's a really, you know, amazing person and, you know, fascinating subject, and so you just want to hold on her. But you know, we did some tests when we took footage to our post house, because, you know, we were like, gosh, some of this stuff we're pushing in really close and we wanted to make sure that it would hold up, and it just held up incredibly well. So we had so much freedom where we could really push in close on her, and that worked. That, you know, was so effective. Sometimes you just want to be right there, you know, with your subject. So.
And again, it's mm-hmm. like it really helped that being 320 ASA, you know, deep stop at 4K.
Yeah, that's incredibly. I haven't heard anybody shooting that low of an ASA in a long time. Yeah. So that's pretty bold.
Yeah, we were welding with one light.
Richard really, I mean, he went so above and beyond, and he actually got into a wetsuit to shoot part of this film, and I think he should talk a little bit about getting into the Pacific Ocean.
Yeah, right. So there's this moment where Laura Albert is talking about...
She's talking about being underwater and being...
suffocating.
Yeah, feeling... she's talking to her therapist on the phone, and she's talking about how it, when she's talking to him, you know, as this persona of Terminator, she feels like she gets a gasp of air, and then the rest of the time she feels underwater. And so we'd actually, I had some old GoPro footage that I had shot in a pool, And, you know, we kind of mocked out the scene, you know, with this GoPro footage, but knew that we were never going to, it was never going to stay, because I'm actually in the footage, you know, like, so, but anyway, so then Richard and Jeff went to the beach.
Right, yeah, we ended up, Jeff kind of ended up, and Michelle would give me, siphon off these little laundry lists of shots. They're like, okay, we need this, we need that, we need this, you know, when I would just be like, all right, just give me the one DC, and I'm like, let me take care of it. So that this underwater shot was one of those. And I went swimming in the ocean with the GoPro in the summer when it was nice and warm, a little too sunny for the mood. And then I went swimming with my son in the Santa Monica College pool. So I gave them two different feels. And then they put it in. They're like, ah, Jeff wasn't loving the wide-angle GoPro kind of feel. So he's like, all right, let's just get a... DSLR from Vice Magazine and with underwater housing, and let's go in, and even though we're going to shoot H.264, it would just give us more control with better lenses and so forth. So we kept on pushing it off and pushing it off and pushing it off, and before we knew it, it was wintertime. And now it was butt cold, freezing, I think like the day before Christmas.
It was and, Christmas Eve morning.
And it was like victory at sea. It was like 6 foot waves with like a massive riptide. Yes. And I know. And so I suit up, and it's blowing, and I go out, and I really wanted to actually swim quite far, because the shot was going down, or what is it? It's actually, it's like going down and then coming up.
And popping up, yeah.
And then popping up, two separate pieces. And long story short, I did not drown, obviously I'm here, but it was difficult. it was a difficult shot, and actually I think they ended up sticking with the GoPro footage.
We did actually stay with the original footage.
Right, yeah.
When you're making a film that's about somebody's life and that's going to sort of serve as a document to their life or their legacy, do you think about that when you're shooting the film? Like, the choices you're making are kind of going to be a permanent document to somebody's life story?
This particular film is, this is Laura Albert's story. I mean, it's a similar in, like, The Kid Stays in the Picture. It's like, it's Laura Albert's voice, and it's her telling her story, you know? So really, you know, when Jeff was first interested in making the film, he talks about that was the voice that he found was really missing from a lot of the media coverage. You know, there's a ton of coverage. I mean, if you Google J.T. Leroy, you know, you'll come up with so many articles about it. But, you know, really Laura's voice is missing from that. So this film was, you know, really Laura's perspective and you know, her story. And that's, I think, a really important voice to add to the whole, you know, to the J.T. Leroy story. So
yeah, I agree. I think a lot of people relate to J.T. Leroy with the whole socialite and famous people and the fashion thing when she blew up, but they didn't really dive into her story. You know, every time you would hear about it, it was always about, you know, Bono or Winona Ryder or, you know, all these different famous people that globbed onto her or globbed onto J.T. Leroy, but it wasn't really about Laura Albert, you know, especially when everything came down and pretty much the literary world kind of like walked away from her.
Mm-hmm.
And didn't mm-hmm. Really give her, like, you know, her due respect of being a really good writer.
I mean, we had a lot of interview footage from a number of different people, but what we found is that, you know, and we definitely used some of those interviews, but what we would often find is, like, really we want to hear what Laura has to say about this aspect. I mean, the story has been told from a lot of other perspectives, and we really want to hear her perspective. So that's, you know, it ended up that was how the film really evolved, you know. And, you know, the idea was always to really incorporate her backstory and, like, where she was coming from, because that was also a part of the story that hadn't been told at all, and the parallels between her life and, you know, like, I think there's a lot of emotional parallels between things that she experienced when she was younger and, you know, things as that are part of J.T. Leroy. So that was something that was really important to us to give that voice.
Yeah,
so.
Definitely.
Awesome. Well, I mean, you guys have just been a part of making this film and have just sold it to Amazon and are basically on your way and kicking ass. I mean, you have two films at this festival. What would you say to young filmmakers who are just starting out? Do you have any words of wisdom for people looking at the mountain to climb in front of them and are perhaps a bit daunted by it?
I don't know. I mean, I think, I started out in film school and then really didn't get back on that path until my late 20s. And then I just started doing it. I taught myself Final Cut Pro and I just started taking anything that I could, you know, as ridiculous as some of those early jobs were, and they were all for no money. I just started doing it and you know, really trying to learn from people that I could. And, I assisted a lot of really great editors and learned from them. And, I mean, it's never too late. You know, I always think, gosh, where would I be now if I had really started doing this right out of college? But, it's never too late to get back to doing something that you love. And, just be prepared to work for free for a while. What would you say?
The older you get, you become a little bit more wise. And I think the biggest thing is, first of all, just go out and do it. Just shoot. Just do whatever you want. Whether you do it, just be proactive. Just dive in. And then the other thing is it's really important to listen and observe. You get a lot of young people out there that don't listen and they don't observe. So when you're on working with people, it's a collaborative effort, but the best thing is to actually just sit back, let other people talk, hear what people have to say, and move from there. Yeah.
I like Richard's answer. I say that too. That's my answer too.
it's a good way to keep yourself out of trouble too.
Right on. Well, thank you so much, Richard and Michelle, for joining us, and thanks to Canon for hosting us. And best of luck with the film and the rest of the festival.